everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you with the Positive Mind here, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursdays on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York City. Exciting New York City. Exciting WBAI. Sometimes calm, sometimes exciting. Exciting to some and calm to others.
Correctly. Well said, Armand.
That's depending what it's all on about how, today.
Depending on how long or short their jeans are.
You know, and we're not talking about fashion, my friends.
Mm-mm.
No, no, no. You know, people with blue eyes have a hard time using chopsticks.
Hmm.
And this is what we're going to explore today. It is true.
Yes.
It's true. If you ever gone to a restaurant where they offer you chopsticks, the people with the blue eyes tend to put down the chopsticks, and the people with the brown eyes tend to master them a lot easier.
It's been genetically established.
Whatever that means, genetically established. Well, we've come across some interesting information. Yesterday we talked about family depression. We talked about maternal depression. And part of what the author who was with us yesterday spoke about, well, she talked about the short genes and the long genes, and she made reference to chromosome 11. As if you didn't have enough things in your life. We are now going to talk about a gene called 4D4DR, right?
Yes.
D4DR?
Yes, D4DR.
Mm-hmm. D4DR. There are a lot of genes that make up for yourself. But here's the way we used to look at it. If you had a neurological disorder or a psychological disorder, people used to think a long time ago, in the 1800s and 1900s, they would think it was genetic.
Mm-hmm.
They would say, they wouldn't say genetic, they would say you inherited this psychological problem. If your mother was crazy, you're crazy. If your grandmother was crazy, it's likely you're going to be crazy. They thought that you inherited mental illness.
Right.
And for a long while, we had to spend time as therapists disproving this and saying to people, no, it's not true. Just because your mother or your father had an illness doesn't mean that you will. Well, here comes the information from D4DR, or chromosome 11, as it's sometimes called, just as a fun name, saying to us, no, it's not true. It is true. It's not true that you will be, but that these genes do lay down an imprint.
Mm.
We're going to break some of that down for you today because we have learned there are some amazing things that we learn from the imprint of these genes. What we're learning from genetics is just amazing about personality characteristics. Not that they are set in stone, because the human being is an amazing thing. The human being has many factors that go into creating what a human being is, but one thing for sure, you can or cannot inherit a predisposition. And now they're seeing it actually physically along the size of a gene. Let's talk about gene size, Roberta.
Sure. Well, there's medium, there's small, there's large. So this is a, what we're talking about is a genetic sequence that is part of a gene. A gene, imagine it's like a string of pearls, let's say. It looks like that. And so it's made of sequence. And so you might have 5 red pearls and 6 yellow pearls and 7 green pearls. And then when you have the strand, you look at the strand and that's the gene. So there's a particular sequence of pearls, let's say, of amino acids that when some people have in their genes, they have this particular sequence repeated more often than other people, than the majority of the people. What they've discovered, geneticists, is that these people that have more of these sequences in their genes have a different way of utilizing dopamine.
Okay, now wait, we're there. We're closely there. She talked about a 5-4-3 sequence or something like that. You talked about having 5 pearls, 4 pearls, 3 pearls, or any different number of different pearls. Now, once you have a sequence laid down, the sequence is repeated. You have to get this. So within a gene, you get a sequence, and then the sequence is repeated, and then the sequence is repeated again, and then repeated again.
Yeah, let's say that you have a pattern whereby 3 yellow pearls are repeated 3 times in the necklace. But let's say that that's the necklace the way it was designed, but then someone decides that they want to add 2 more sequences of the 3 green pearls to that necklace. So now you have a necklace which is identical to the original one, except for the fact that it has 2 more sequences of 3 green pearls in the whole necklace. Does that give a visual, Armand?
It's close. The point is that sometimes a sequence is so long that some sequences make the gene long. And they actually don't make the gene longer. They're the same size, you know. So if you imagine if a whole gene is 28 long, whatever it is, 28 chromosomes long, and another gene is 28 chromosomes long, the ones that have the sequences in it have more sequences in it, is called the long gene. Long gene. Remember the long gene watches? This is the long gene, the one that has more sequences. Then there's the short gene, which has fewer sequences. It means the pattern is repeated only once or twice.
And that's the original one. That's the one most people have. But now what we have found is there are some people who have more sequences in their genes, and so the geneticists have described that genetic structure as long genes versus short genes.
Now, we heard about that yesterday when we were talking about depression in parents. People with the longer genes
have a way in the dopamine receptors. Their dopamine receptors are less effective, let's say, at utilizing dopamine than the rest of us.
Dopamine, is that nice thing?
It is a very nice thing.
Dopamine makes you feel good. Dopamine makes you dopey.
Dopamine,
the good kind of dopey. That's how you remember dopamine.
Dopamine.
I asked one of my friends the other day, do you remember what dopamine is? Because I've talked about it so much. And she said it's one of those chemicals, right? Dopamine is the good dope.
Dopamine is the neurotransmitter that makes us feel awake, but focused and centered, calm, responsive, aware,
effective.
So it's not, it doesn't make us hyper, and it doesn't make us sleepy. It's the one that we would like to have most of the time when we are awake. We'd like to be dopaminized.
Right. Dopaminic.
But so some people, and this has been found especially in children with ADD and HDAD, the receptors for dopamine don't work as well as other people's. And so these people can't utilize their dopamine as well as other people. And a whole host of repercussions emerge.
So those folks who can seem to produce the dopamine are known to have short genes. According to the geneticists, you know, it's like one geneticist is talking to a geneticist. Two geneticists go into a bar and one sits down and says to the other geneticist, hey, you see that girl over there? I'd like to meet her. And one geneticist, yeah, but I think she's got a short gene.
Mm.
You know, I don't know if I want to meet somebody with a short gene because she'd be a little sleepy. You see, I'd rather meet somebody with a long gene because maybe she smokes like I do. More likely to be true, by the way.
Right.
Right? People with long genes tend to smoke. But we've learned a lot of differences between the long genes and the short genes. Let's talk about want to talk about sex? Everybody wants to talk about sex.
Sure. Well, according to these findings,
What was this, Harvard? Harvard, where did we get this?
No, we get it from GeneTech, which is part of the Telegraph in the UK. It's a newspaper. And so this research comes out of a company called GeneTech. And so this is from the GeneTech archives. And so here it says that people with long genes, and let me just remind you, long genes means that they have this genetic sequence repeated more so than other people, and so they are less able to process dopamine effectively. So they need more stimuli than other people. They need more excitement. They need more things. They are more risk-seeking and more adventurous.
Get that clear. They don't need. They have. In other words, they're more excited, right?
Well, no, because if you have less capacity to utilize dopamine, then you need more stimulus in order to get the same excitement as someone who is able to process it better. So, see, if your dopamine doesn't work as well as someone else, that means that you have to work harder to get yourself to the place of being properly in touch with your environment, because otherwise you're kind of unable to connect, and so you're kind of struggling to keep your attention on something, on anything.
You mean if I have short genes, and I could find somebody who I fall in love with, and we make love, and she's got somebody, and she's a short gene kind of person, we make love, we fall asleep, we hold each other all night, it's a wonderful thing. But if I got long genes and she got long genes, we make love, we get up, we go out, we find somebody else.
Correct.
Oh, because now it makes sense.
Because if you're not able,
that's where I was,
to keep yourself dopaminized, then you need to find more things to dopaminize you. I just made that up, that vocabulary, but I think it gives an idea. So what we read is that, for instance, in heterosexual males, human males, people with long genes are 6 times more likely to have had sex with another man. Now, this is heterosexual males. So what we're looking at is someone who is looking for something different, something perhaps a bit risky, something perhaps a bit, you know, exciting because it's unusual, because it's out of the boundaries of the ordinary. In homosexual males, what we have is the people with the long genes are 5 times more likely to have had sex with a woman. Again, same thing. We're looking for, we are describing someone who needs to look for something out of the norm, because the normal world is not stimulating enough for this person. They're not able to satisfy their need to connect with the world because they don't have enough dopamine in their receptors. So they tend to look for more stimulus and more intense stimulus. And therefore, you know, unusual things, risky things, dangerous things, abnormal things, things that might involve danger are very attractive. But Armand, aren't these also the people who, if they're not able to get appropriate stimuli for themselves, might get depressed?
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
Because let's say an ADD child who is in a classroom, and the classroom is not interesting enough for that child. Let's say that most children can sit there and listen to the teacher talk or describe something, but the child with ADD who doesn't have enough dopamine gets bored more easily because he or she's not able to...
No way to settle down.
Right. There's nothing to connect with.
There's no way to settle down. You know, somebody came to me the other day, and he was a man who had a troubled life, and he's lived a troubled life. He's had spent a number of years in prison. And he remembered as a kid that his mother, at age 9, his mother shackled him to the bed at age 9. And he said he couldn't figure out why he was shackled to the bed. He was shackled to the bed because he would get up in the middle of the night and go wandering the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And so the indication was there. There was a reason why he could not sit still early on. Now, what happens to kids like this is they are told, sit still, they are punished,
Right.
They are sent in there, and nobody recognizes that this child is suffering in this condition because nobody understands there is somebody here who doesn't have the necessary chemicals to be able to sit still in this environment. They need freedom.
Well, and also, see, if you don't have enough dopamine, let's say you're listening to someone speak, you're not able to concentrate your mind in listening to what they're saying because you're not being stimulated enough to grab enough of your attention span. So let's say now you put a funny outfit on that person and they start to jump up and down while they speak, well, that might help. Why? Because you're increasing the stimulus, and so the brain is able to grab that stimulus and use it. So children with ADD, children with long genes, children with less dopamine have a difficult time adapting to the normal level of stimulus, and so they seek intensity. And this research is showing us that it's something that is genetically established, meaning it's innate in the individual, and these people are born that way.
Let's talk about stress for a minute. You know, stress is caused by the outside world, by an impending exam, a recent bereavement, or an unrewarding exhaustion of caring for a person with Alzheimer's disease, you know, when you care for somebody. One of cortisol's most surprising effects is that it suppresses the working of the immune system. Now, how do we get to cortisol? Cortisol is the hormone that is secreted under stress.
Right. We get to cortisol because it is a hormone. It is one of the chemicals in the human body that is able to turn genes on and off. So with cortisol, for instance, what we have is an activation of certain genes and a deactivation of other genes. And the reason why we're bringing it up is because what we want to show you is, let's say that you take someone with long genes, someone who has less dopaminergic activity in the brain. We take someone like that and we expose them to stress. Well, that stress is going to have a different effect on them than it has on other people. And because cortisol is a chemical that is able to turn genetic structures on and off, once the cortisol is secreted and once it's maintained, if the stress continues over a period of time, what that can do is it can actually change the genetic structure and activate the genes that Armand was saying, you know, when we come from a family when there is, let's say, mental illness, we have certain genes that could make us more vulnerable to have it ourselves. Well, cortisol is a chemical that is able to turn genes on and off. And so what we're saying here is that what happens to us, what we're exposed to in our environment, in our family, in our experience, in life, in school, and at work, with our relationships, what happens to us really is what activates or deactivates our genetic propensities.
Once under stress, whatever genetic propensity you have, there it may unfold. It's most likely that children who are taking final exams, men and women taking final exams, they're most likely to catch a cold. You know, that's where they catch colds and flus, and nobody could ever figure out why. You know, they always thought, well, because the study halls are contagious. No, it's because the cortisol that's secreted from the strain of the testing shuts off the immune system. Now, this is a silly system because it's a silly human system to shut off the immune system. Why do you think we'd shut off the immune system when somebody's studying for an exam? Do you think it gives them more brain power to shut off their body immune system? Or do you think the body wants to make them sick so that they can somehow inherit or take in some virus that's going to help them cheat on the exams? What do you think? What do you think the body's doing there, Roberta?
Well, see, Armand, I think that this design was established long ago when we lived in caves and we dealt with saber-toothed tigers and Tyrannosaurus Rex, because it turns out that now we're saying that some humans were there when the dinosaurs existed. But anyway, that's a whole other show.
But what purpose could it have served?
Right. Well, cortisol... The system.
I'm going to give the dinosaur a flu if he bites me.
Cortisol.
There it is. There it is right there. All right. Go ahead. Bite me, dinosaur. I'm going to sneeze all over your nose.
Cortisol and the whole stress response.
Stupid.
Is designed to deal with immediate danger. It's not designed to deal with ongoing stress. So in the moment when you're supposed to deal with the saber-toothed tiger, your body brilliantly diverts all energy to the muscles and to making you fit for flight or fight or freeze. And so if the stress is in the moment and it begins and ends in a short amount of time, that's a perfect design. The problem is that our system is not yet adapted to the kind of life that produces constant stress. So I think, Armand, what you're asking is a question that why are we designed that way? Because we're designed still as if we were still living in the caves. The body has not yet had the time to catch up with modern life and its demands and structures. So that's why that system is set up that way.
But there is a magic behind it.
What do you mean?
You see, punchline time. Now there's a magic behind all of this. Because we have the ability to automatically shut off and turn on genetic structures, we come to the glory of the human being. The ability of the human being to turn on and off the genetic message. Only humans can do it. Animals do it automatically, you know, and I will give you an example of catching a cold when you're studying for a test. That's one of the automatics. But humans have been able to turn on and turn off genetic messages so that we are not so much at the mercy of our genetic signals. People with blue eyes, it turns out, are people who cannot, in general, learn how to use
chopsticks.
Chopsticks, right? However, they could turn the signal off, and they could learn to use chopsticks.
You know, it's very interesting, Armand, that the human DNA, we see that only about 5% of it is actively working to replicate cells and to do what we know DNA to be doing, which is to maintain our structures alive and functioning. 95% of it, geneticists have called junk DNA, because they can't tell what it's doing. It's not actually doing anything that they can detect with the technology that we have. However, in Russia, I was reading just the other day, some scientists have decided to try and figure out what that DNA is doing, that DNA that's not replicating. And what they did was get together with some linguists. And the geneticists and the linguists figure out that the human DNA is actually like a language, like an alphabet, and that our genetic structure is really like a set of sentences, almost as if our genetic inheritance were spelled out in a book where we are described in every detail. And that if you can decode that language, you can change the sentences and change the words to make it what you would prefer it to be. So it turns out that that junk DNA, that DNA that it, that seems to just be sitting in our cells and not do anything, it's actually the book that describes us, the book that tells us who we are and what we are about. And that book is not a static book. It's not a book that's just written and that's it. It's a book that keeps changing because we write it as we live. And humans, more so than any other species, is interacting with its own DNA to the point where we are choosing how we are evolving. That's the most astounding discovery that comes out of this.
And as I was saying about that man who came to us a little, came to me earlier this week, he said, all my life I've been running, the guy who was bound to a table and he was running like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as a kid they chained him down. And then he said, the other day I was just sitting alone and he said, and I took a deep breath and I closed my eyes and for the first time, Armand, he said to me, for the first time I cleared my mind of all thought.
Hmm.
He said, the very first time, he was like 42 years old. He said, I think that's the way I've got to go. He said, what do you think? I said, sure sounds right to me. He said, I cleared my mind of all thought for the first time in my life. Now, here I am, this very high-priced, important shrink, and he's coming to me. He said, what do you think? But he had the answer right there. He was able to turn off the button.
Sure.
He was somebody who was spending all his life surviving, and right before he came to see me, he learned that he could defeat the code that said, watch out, watch out, watch out, watch right. out. Oops, you don't have to watch out for a minute.
Hmm.
And he closed his eyes, and the next thing you knew, he could be quiet. And he got quiet. And he sat there, and he got quiet, and then I got quiet with him. And it was absolutely perfect and peaceful, and we watched history change. A beautiful thing. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to be taking your calls when we come back. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll take some of your calls, say hello to you as well. And we'll be back with you in a couple of minutes. Bye-bye. Well, we'll be right back. to begin again. Yes, we can begin again. That's the beauty of the human species. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, right here in the middle of the dial. Listen to support at WBAI in New York City. Hey, Roberta, pretty music, eh? Elemental Chill, La Taverna de Lac, du Lac. Hey, Roberta, you know, so let's get to that idea. We're going to take your call at 212-209-2900. Shyness, you know, there's one thing about, we were talking about genes, talking about some of what we've learned from chromosome 11, which is a genetic predisposition to certain things, like, you know, some people.
You know, Armand, we were talking about these long genes as geneticists are describing them, and these are genetic sequences in some people that make them less responsive to dopamine and therefore less capable of paying attention to things. But if you think about the way humanity is evolving and you look at the amount of information that is coming at us today compared even just to half a century ago. I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't have a TV. And I look at what my kids have today and how many things are being thrown at them continuously. The brain has to adapt to this onslaught of information. So it seems to me perfectly understandable that our DNA would change to give us a breather, meaning to make us less capable of paying attention. Because if we could pay attention to everything that happens, we would go nuts. There's so much happening all the time. So the brains of children that are born today are designed to be less absorbing of the information that surrounds them, that comes at them. Well, well done, I say. Well done. Except that the educational system, for instance, to name just one institution, is still functioning under the assumption that brains don't change and that children should be educated today the way they were educated 100 years ago, as if humanity was not evolving.
Wait, you got so many concepts in there, we're going to have to probably spend
See,
5 years.
What did I tell you? I'm
yeah, you
going
just did
too
it.
Fast.
You just did it, right. Yeah, as we said, we're talking about genetics. And
we're talking about long genes and short genes.
And that you're right if you can't follow the program, because we could just give you a whole bunch of things to talk about. But you're right, you know, Roberta, because the point of it is that it's not that it's wrong, you know, that there are some of you who are born to follow a sequence, and there are others of you who are born to not follow the sequence, and both are necessary. We need the ones who are going to line up the ducks and the ones who are going to scatter the ducks. We need both. And in order for us to survive, instead of trying to be both people, it seems like we're developing both. And I think you're right, Roberta. We have an educational system that is just honoring one at the moment. We're saying only those of you who line it up are going to get the credentials. But, you know, it's not true, because the geniuses now are being picked out of school who are the ones who have the most creative minds. You see, it's no longer happening just that way. Now we're looking for the kids who could think outside the box.
And the thing is, what we're discovering is that in order to think outside the box, very often the way in which you would tell that someone is like that is they don't fit in the box. So their behavior, for instance, could be described as antisocial.
And you might find them at home sitting in their room, mm-hmm, with their computer, you know,
exactly,
doing umi umi.
And it's really a shame, in my opinion, to label a kid antisocial when that child could be the most gifted, and it's simply a case of genetic adaptation to excessive information that is what we're all exposed to. And it's very interesting that what's emerging out of the research on the human genome is that our DNA is an interactive structure, meaning that it's not given to us, and that's how it is. It's given to us, and we interact with it, and we change it, and it responds, and we change it back, and it responds, and it changes, and it comes back, and it's constantly evolving according to what we do, and it tries to help us adapt to what we create.
We better take some calls. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's take one of your calls. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Thank you for your wonderful program. I like your discussion of the sequence of genes and the combinations that you have discussed in your excellent program, which I always enjoyed.
Thank you.
I would like to ask a question
sure.
in particular, if I may. And that is this. I have Charcot Marie tooth, which is a neuromuscular disease. How can I relate that to the sequence of genes and work on it?
Well,
because it is doing a devastating job on me.
What is the illness you have?
Charcot Marie tooth.
Do you know anything
about
that?
It's a disease, a neuromuscular disease, which is considered familial. My mother had it. Her sister had it. My sister had it, etc.
Yes. Well, you know, every disease that we label as genetically inherited is something that runs in the family. It's a pattern that.
Do you know this disease, Roberta?
Well, I think from what I understand, it has to do with the malfunctioning of the skeletal muscular structure.
Tell
is
us
that
a
right?
little about this illness.
Well, the illness is a disease which has its impact on the peripheral fingers and feet first,
mm-hmm.
and it debilitates the use of those over time. Now, I have worked a long time, very muscular guy, but lost a tremendous amount of weight and loss of capacity.
Well, you know, maybe this is the kind of a thing that maybe Roberta and you could go over in private, because it sounds to me like something that's going to take a little bit of research, and Roberta can respond to you about. Right, why don't you get in touch with her directly about this?
How should I do that?
RobertaForHealth@AOL.com.
RobertaForHealth@AOL.com. Okay.
And this way you could write to her and you could give her the real specific spelling and she could do some research.
Now, what is that address? That's a email address?
Yes.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. 212-209-2900. This is Armand DeMille. Let's do a little more. Hi there. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Good afternoon, everybody.
Yes.
I have a question for you. If cortisol can change the DNA, what about children who are abused in utero? If, for example, they've been abused only once, already their DNA has changed. But if they have been abused repeatedly, let's imagine how much the DNA has changed. And if on top of that, they are abused after they are born, either because they are neglected or physically abused, I mean, they have little chance of not having a DNA that is so altered that it could function normally.
Yeah, did you have this happen to you as a child?
Well, my mother pounded on her belly when I was almost eight and a half months old, and I escaped by just being born. But I have been interested in this kind of children, and I suddenly have it triggered something in my mind. No wonder these kids, even after they have been born many years, will be freezing, for example, at the sound of something or at some words or at some situations. They will freeze or start being completely startled because maybe the DNA has been programmed.
Yeah, I don't think what we said was that the DNA gets changed. You know, the DNA is there, but the reaction that some people have is a lot more sensitive than others. Sounds to me like you had a mother who was not, you know, completely, didn't make you feel completely safe as a child. Is that what
that
you're saying?
That was the World War II on top of that. But if the DNA changes when there is stress, So all these children who are abused in utero have a DNA completely altered.
Say it again to me. I'm sorry.
If stress changes the DNA,
yeah,
then children who are abused in utero have already a DNA that is completely altered.
In effect, yes. I don't think it's exactly that the DNA are altered because of the children being abused, but the children.
But the cortisol.
Yeah, the children are
cortisol.
Abused. Yes. Yes. Yes.
If the cortisol is able to change a gene.
Yes.
This is fascinating.
Yes, I agree with you.
Thank you.
Just hang in there a second now.
I didn't get your name.
My name is Janine.
Janine. Janine, what we are saying is that, yes, it's true that what happens to us, including secretion of certain hormones, can alter our genetic structure. However, what we are saying, and I hope that you hear us say that, is that we are interacting constantly with our genetic structure.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you have been abused, you can make choices that, you know, I mean, you're not powerless even in the bleakest situation. So, you know, we're saying that, yes, the cortisol can turn genes off and on. But we're also saying that that you are constantly interacting with your DNA and in a way shaping it with the choices that you make in life, with the people you choose
interact.
To associate with. Exactly. So
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want anyone to hear us say that we are at the mercy of negative forces, because in fact we're saying the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Armand? Isn't that
exactly
what we're saying?
Exactly, that we are the first species that has the power to make the changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the really important message that we are offering today, that yes, we have this information about what can harm us, but we also have the knowledge now in studying the DNA. We have the knowledge that DNA responds to what we choose, to what we do. So, you know, so you have a lot of power there. That's what I'm trying to say.
So visualization really can change something then.
Yes, yes, specifically, and a lot of other things that are really possible manipulations that we are now learning to do, like the young man who said the other day, I learned to quiet my mind.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just what a thing to do.
Mm.
You know, some people learn to stop blaming people. You know what I'm talking about, don't you?
Yes. No. Thank you so, so much.
Sure.
Enjoy your day and have wonderful holidays.
Thank
holidays
you.
Holidays to you, too. Hi, Armand. Well, 212-209-2900.
I hear an echo, Armand.
Yeah, it's all right.
It's okay.
212-209-2900. Hi there, you're on the air.
Armand?
Yes.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Lucia calling.
Hello, Lucia.
How are you? Hi, Roberta.
Hello.
Nice German name you have there.
Thank you. This is a wonderfully fascinating topic today, particularly for me because I'm 7.5 months pregnant. And I think every day about my genetics and how that's going to affect my baby. And one of the things that I have tried to do my entire adult life is reprogram my thought patterns from negative to positive thinking mm-hmm. as much as possible. And I'm praying that that has some effect on my child. And also, my father was an alcoholic, and so my husband always said to me, and I agree, of course, you know, we have to be particularly careful with our own daughter, you know, that she's a little bit more vulnerable than perhaps someone else to the disease of alcoholism. And so I guess what I'm wondering is how much of this, what I consider a blueprint of our genetic makeup, is... Like, I know mentally we can change our thought patterns and clearly, if we're being more positive, we're going to want to pass that on to our children. But how much of our physical makeup genetically is actually possible to change? I mean, it just seems so, I mean, it just seems so far out of reach to me.
Sounds like you and your husband are very concerned, loving parents. But sometimes in this new age, parents get so overly concerned that they trigger a whole bunch of neurotic stuff in a child, you know?
Gotcha.
Sometimes they don't want the child to scrape its knee when it goes out to play because, you know, they don't want the child to play. And there's a certain amount of freedom you have to allow a child so the child learns on their own. I don't
right.
know how cautious you can be with a child about their becoming, being careful about their own alcoholism, except maybe how you, the parents, demonstrate how easy it is to move to substances for solving, you know, physical problems, like how quickly you drop aspirin or Valium or stuff like that, which I'm sure you don't do already because I could tell from the way you're talking. What do
right.
you think, Roberta?
Well, I mean, you said only one thing about your father. You said he was an alcoholic. I don't know. If that's what's on your mind, then you're already shaping things with your mind. How about saying something really good about your father? What was really good about him? Do you remember anything good?
He absolutely loved nature. He would take home every stray animal that was on the street.
He was very compassionate.
Yes.
And sensitive.
Extremely.
That's it. That's what I like to hear about your father, and I'm sure that's what your child would like to hear as well.
Absolutely. I just, a light bulb triggered for me because, you know, we had to go for genetic counseling, you know, in today's day, that's almost, you know, something everyone does. And just a lot of things came up that seemed irreversible to me. I mean, I don't want
well, if you think they are irreversible, then they are.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. I was just trying to differentiate between where these patterns that we're talking about today, is it all mental? Is it just when we
no
are
one
positive?
Knows. No one can tell you. No one can give you that answer. You're looking for certainty, and there is no such thing. What we are saying is that if we put energy into fearful thoughts, then that's what you create in yourself and in your child. If
right.
you talk about your father and the first thing you say is, my father was so compassionate, that's going to give your child a very different structure than if you say, my father was an alcoholic. You see what I'm saying?
Sure, absolutely.
And that's just me, and I'm not the expert, you know.
Right.
I'm just someone who believes in certain things and not others, that's all.
Right. Well, I've seen studies done when I was at an ashram where a woman who was a specialist in meditation but who was also a scientist was able to prove after testing brain pattern changes from, you know, negative to positive.
There you go.
Just by, you know, meditation and positive affirmations.
There you go.
So I'm
So the
thrilled.
Next time you say something about your father, how about saying he was a wonderful guy?
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
Lucia, I want to thank you very much. When is your baby's due in 1.5 months?
She's due February 24th.
Hmm.
So, but I have an intuition she might be a little bit late. I don't know why.
Yeah,
just a feeling.
How are you feeling?
A little nervous, but more excited than nervous. And, you know, my emotions go up and down like crazy, but I guess that's just normal. Because
do you understand about that, the emotional swing that you go through nowadays?
You mean pertaining to my pregnancy or just society?
Pertaining to your pregnancy and looking for what's right and what's wrong and what you should be doing and shouldn't be doing and how you should be thinking and shouldn't be thinking.
Yeah, it's a huge responsibility.
Yeah,
because I am an emotional girl by nature. But and I think if I were having a boy, it would feel a little different. But because I'm a woman, and I just have dealt with so many of my own, you know, challenges as a woman, I do worry about what she's got to deal with. But hopefully, you know, with my positive, you know, input and my husband's magnificent personality and loving, caring soul that he is, she'll have a pretty good start.
Nice beginning. Thanks for calling in.
Thanks, Armand. Thanks, Roberta. You guys are the best.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti, with you at The Positive Mind. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. We're going to be discussing some interesting aspects with Dr. Kent Robert Shaw and other guests, interesting aspects about the seasonal mood, and we'll be sure to tune in at 1 p.m. Now listen, my friends, be sure to tune into the website of WBAI.org. You can listen to this program, but you can also explore WBAI.org for all of its wonderful things. There's so many things that go on at WBAI that you could see through the webpage. They do a lot of work on there and updating and finding out what new programs are going to be on. So be sure to search that, and you could hear the program on the web through that at www.wbai.org. You could also go through our webpage at thepositivemind.com, and Roberta's at, what is yours, Roberta?
Roberta at creativehealthsolutions.org.
Creativehealthsolutions.org. Back with you tomorrow, my friends, at 1 p.m.
In New York City, it's raining heavily at 156. You're tuned to 99.5 FM WBAI, listener-supported, commercial-free community radio. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. The Positive Mind with Armand DeMille, back tomorrow at 1 p.m.